What is up? We are back. Tony in the Field.
Tony in the Field. Oh, my God. I love those guys.
So excited to be on Tony in the Field. Love the show.
Oh, man. I can't wait. I'm fired up. Preston, what's on the menu, brother?
The gloves are coming off.
James catches, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound box. Back out to Allen. History point of bang! Tie game with 5 seconds remaining.
Swoops. Dancing for the win! Texas is back, folks!
Indiana's 9 out of 12.
Oh! Gerald Green! That's a man's jam!
Hey, what is up, everybody? This is Tony and the Field coming to you on Sunday, November 29th, a little after 9 o'clock Pacific time out here on the West Coast. I'm the Field, a.k.a. Preston Highfield. He is Big Tony, a.k.a. Anthony Piganelli, holding it down in the Bay Area. Coincidentally, I am in the Bay Area as well on my way down to Orange County to tour a couple of apartments. Big Tony and I, shockingly, did not link. We are doing our very best to participate in the quarantine lifestyle, as it were, due to COVID-19. But we'll be doing in-person, safely, pods together soon. What's up, Big Tony? How you doing?
Chief, good to join you, man. Sunday night, but folks, we still are on the grind for this content game. We get it in whenever we can. We do it for you guys. We love you. And I'm just excited to crank this one out. It'll be a quicker pod than we normally do. But as usual, man, there's just so much to get to that we know that we couldn't leave the folks hanging.
Folks, we have on the menu a breakdown of the Civil War. We'll keep it brief-ish because we know you don't maybe want to relive what happened in that 41-38 loss for the Ducks in Corvallis, Oregon the other night. But we got to talk about it a bit. Plus, you know, Big Tony is here for it. He is here for the Harbaugh slander as Jim Harbaugh loses at home to a winless and borderline lifeless Penn State team this past weekend. We'll break down the Iron Bowl, what in the hell happened with LSU, Les Miles, Vandy football, Michigan State beating Northwestern, quick little chat about the Egg Bowl, and maybe some more. But we start, Big Tony, with the Civil War. Oregon State 41, Oregon 38. I still can't really believe it happened, but it happened, folks. The Beavers beat the defending Pac-12 and Rose Bowl champion Oregon Ducks, 41-38. Jeremiah Jefferson goes for 226 rushing yards and 2 touchdowns. Oregon's Tyler Shuck, 285 passing yards, 2 touchdowns, but 2 picks, both of which were pretty costly and really not great throws, although I don't think Shuck leading the offense to 38 points really cost Oregon the game. We can break that down in just a bit. Ducks did an okay job rushing, 183 total rushing yards, but the Beavers racked up 269 rushing yards and 4 rushing touchdowns. It's the Beavers' second Civil War win in 14 years, the other coming in 2016 when Oregon trotted out the worst defense in program history, literally, statistically speaking. Of course, led by Brady Hoke back then. Ducks were up 31-19 in this game, Big Tony, but they blow the lead in the fourth quarter. Oregon State scored 22 points in the fourth quarter, although to be fair, they were driving at the end of the third quarter, and then they just basically punched it in to start the fourth quarter. But still, 22-7 in the fourth quarter, they outscored the Ducks, and Oregon couldn't stop them on the ground.
This is what I was worried about all of last week. Remember how we previewed the show and you were talking about how Oregon was a 14-point favorite and should we be worried? I said, forget the spread for a second. I'm legitimately worried about the game. And I highlighted Jermar Jefferson on purpose. I knew he was going to have a monster game. I didn't know he was going to rush for 220, but I knew he was going to have a big game and that was going to be a huge reason why the Beavers would have a chance. And ultimately, it was one of the big reasons why they won. I think him and their defense giving up a lot of points but made timely plays. And I think those 2 picks that Shuck had were terrible picks, and they really helped the Beavers out. They ended up getting 14 points off both of those. And that's a huge difference in the game, man. So Jefferson and the defense, they balled out. Oregon State is just not that bad anymore, Chief. They're no longer the doormat of the Pac-12. They're no longer the laughingstock of the Pacific Northwest and the West Coast. The Beavers, they're somewhat legit, man. They're not obviously top tier, but they're middle of the pack at the very least now. And I think with the way that Jonathan Smith has these guys fired up, again, a lot of these guys, they're not highly recruited. They're not world beaters. They're not getting the players that Oregon or USC are getting on the West Coast. But they have a lot of fight, man, and they flat out, they make plays in big moments, and I don't think they're afraid anymore, and I think they got the right guys, and I think they certainly have the right coach in Jonathan Smith, man. I was worried about this game coming in, and I was right about that, man, and they got a big win. It sucks for the Ducks fans, and it sucks for the Ducks. You got to give Oregon State a ton of credit, Chief. They really deserve that.
Exactly. They definitely do, and no home crowd to even really support them in that game, which would have, you would have thought, would have helped even more. It was a weird foggy game, resembled the 05 Fog Bowl, a game that Oregon won by like six touchdowns, but Oregon State battled through it in this one. And also, I don't think the fog really affected the players much. Cristobal was asked about it afterwards, and he said he could see the other side of the field. It was got really thick in like the second quarter, but kind of subsided by the midway through the third and for the rest of the game. I agree. You should give Oregon State props. I think Jonathan Smith's a really good coach. I think they have a pro style approach that's not anything crafty in terms of trick plays or spread and tempo or anything like that, is what I mean by crafty. But it's assignment football. It's well done. They obviously have a star player in Jermar Jefferson, who looked like a star as a true freshman, even when they only won two games. But, kind of regressed a little bit last year. I don't have his numbers in front of me or anything, but you just didn't hear much about him as much in his second year. But he's legit. He's running wild on multiple teams. And that's what I said about UCLA as well. I like last week when we were breaking down Oregon's narrow win over UCLA, I said, Oregon's defense did not look good, but UCLA has also improved. They're finally running the Chip Kelly offense, where it's spread, no huddle, up tempo, quality running back in Demetric Felton. It's back-to-back weeks. Oregon's faced a really, really solid Pac-12 running back, and they've not been able to stop him or even really contain him in back-to-back weeks. I don't really remember Oregon getting run up on this other than 2016 in terms of a team just rushing the ball down their throat and there was nothing they could do about it. Because let's be honest, Tristan Gebbia, I mean, he actually played fine. He hit some big like slant routes on third down. And it's not like he's working with like all world wide receivers. Trevon Bradford, Oregon City High School in the Portland suburbs grad. He's probably their best receiver. I think he had a close to 100-yard game. But in general, it's not like he's throwing to Isaiah Hodgins like they had last year or any of the weapons Oregon has. But they just managed the game super well. And it was pretty clear to me, I thought, that Jonathan Smith outcoached Cristobal and really outcoached Andy Avalos, which is, I guess, where I want to go next. I have seen some people on Twitter, and again, it is folks on Twitter, so let's all take this with a grain of salt, but people fed up with Andy Avalos, maybe losing a little bit of faith in him after he was unbelievable last year as the DC, essentially won Oregon the Rose Bowl along with Herbert's rushing touchdowns with how good Oregon's defense was. They were really good the whole year other than the UW game. They weren't very good, and the Arizona State game, they got beat deep a couple times. But in general, it was a rock-solid defense last year. So that's the big question, is what's happening on defense, Big Tony? And I'll let you take the first shot at that. What's going on defense for Oregon?
I think last year there were just so many playmakers, Chief, that they were just able to make so many big plays and hold contain and do all of their individual assignments at such a high level that this year with the opt-outs in the secondary and a lot of new faces, they're just not performing. Now, some of the blame can be on the players, but a lot of it definitely has to be on Avalos. I want to read something to you, Chief. In the Civil War, this game on Friday at Corvallis against Oregon State, the Ducks gave up 532 total yards and 41 points. But again, 500 plus yards. This should not be happening to Oregon State. You want to give up the buck 50 to Jermar on the ground? Fine. He's an incredible back. The running game's established to Oregon State. That makes sense. You can't give up 263 in the passing game too, and you can't give up 41 points and expect to win. That's just not going to cut it. Like I said, some of it's going to be on the players. A lot of it, though, has to be on Avalos. If you don't have the players that you have from last year, you need to sit down and take a hard look at the scheme that you're running and switch some things up, figure it out. It's just like Don Brown over at Michigan. Don Brown had all those amazing players over the years, and Michigan's defense was a top unit. Now a lot of those guys are gone, and they haven't reloaded in the recruiting department. And his man-to-man defense is getting torched by Big Ten teams that aren't even that good. So for Avalos specifically, I think he needs to look at his players and analyze the scheme and really understand what they're not doing well and try to fix that in terms of just they don't have the talent that they do that they had last year.
No doubt. I think that's it. I'm not really losing any faith in Andy Avalos as a defensive coordinator, but he does need to adjust given the fact that they lost so much talent. There are a couple things on the defense I want to talk about. Number one is the loss of talent. Four of the best defensive players, certainly in the Pac-12 and maybe even in the country last year, are no longer with the program. Troy Dye, who is now in the league, started on Monday Night Football for the Vikings a week or two ago. Javon Holland, who's going to be a first-rounder, opted out. Brady Breeze, defensive MVP of the Rose Bowl and one of the real great defensive players in the Pac-12 last year, obviously opted out. And then Thomas Graham, an absolute lockdown corner, is gone to the league. He had some pick sixes in his career. In general, he was just a lockdown guy. And D'Amador Lenore opposite him, who's obviously still with Oregon, but those guys are all gone. Those guys are not at all easy to replace. I totally get that. It's like you were alluding to with Don Brown. You know, over the years, they've had Rashawn Gary, Chase Winovich, Jordan Lewis, Jabril Peppers, some like legitimate NFL players on the roster that are now gone. That's what's happening with Oregon, where it's disappointing in terms of where you actually do have talent. Yeah, and I'm not saying the secondary doesn't have talent because they do, but they're just young, and I'll give them a pass this year for even just having a down year with all the departures. The front seven is still talented and experienced. I mean, Jordan Scott, Austin Faliu, and Kayvon up front. Like, where's the disruption? Kayvon finally beat a double team and got tackled. Kayvon's getting double teamed like every game. And they're also dropping him back into coverage, which is kind of odd to me. I don't understand why they don't. And obviously, Avalos knows a lot more about defense than us. Like how Ohio State used Chase Young. They put four down linemen. Granted, Chase Young's different. He's obviously just different. But they put four down linemen on defense, and then Chase Young was just on the very edge, and he just rushed the left tackle. It was impossible to double team him because he just rushed the outside. I don't understand why. I know Oregon likes to run a 3-3-5 base look, but I would just think about putting a fourth lineman down so Kayvon can try to get on the edge a bit more. And then secondly, you know, the linebackers, I think Noah Sewell's already kind of the heart and soul of the defense, along with Verone McKinley, who I've heard speak in recent weeks at media availabilities. He's a super well-spoken, seems like a really mature young guy, really, really good potential leader for the defense, if not already. Him and Lenore, I'd put in that category. But I think that's just the thing, is Troy Dye was just the heart and soul of the defense, in addition to being their leading tackler last year and all the years before that. And he's gone. And it just, I think there's maybe not, there's like a little bit of a leadership alpha dominant void that hasn't been filled yet in the middle of that defense. And I think Noah Sewell is starting to fill it. And he certainly looks like a guy who will end up being a high quality NFL draft pick, but it's just not there quite yet.
It's not there quite yet. And I think big picture rest of the season, Chief, it's a liability obviously, but at this point the Ducks still control their own destiny to win the Pac-12. They still control their own destiny to get a good bowl game. And it really just depends on them cleaning up the mistakes on the defensive end. If they don't do it, it's not the end of the world. It's such a wacky short season. A lot of folks are saying that this is just a really good opportunity for the young guys to get reps. But ultimately, you know, as competitive as this team and this fan base and this university is, definitely want to see some improvement. And at the very, very least, got to beat UW, Chief. Cannot let those fake tough Huskies, who somehow squeaked out of Seattle with a fraudulent win over Utah on Saturday night, cannot let those fake tough Huskies beat the Ducks in Autzen Stadium this year.
The fake tough Huskies do come to Autzen in 2 weeks. As long as Oregon wins at Cal next weekend, then that matchup with UW will be a showdown for the right to go to the Pac-12 title, right, to win the North. Ducks are playing at Cal at 4 o'clock this Saturday. It's an ESPN game that was just recently announced. That was an insane, insane game in Seattle. I have no idea how Utah lost that game. They were up 21-0 at halftime, and they lose 24-21. Their freshman running back, Ty Jordan, who's a good player, going to be a really good player, fumbles the ball at the 10. I'm talking about Utah. Fumbles the ball at the 10 when they're driving in the third quarter. Might have even been the start of the fourth quarter. And a score there would have essentially iced the game. And instead, he fumbles it, and UW runs it back like 30 yards, and then they end up scoring. That was just an insane, insane sequence that really soiled that game for the Utes. Quickly to kind of wrap up the Civil War, just in general, like I think the big picture takeaway, obviously, in addition to the defense just struggling, is the fact that Oregon still controls its own destiny. If they win their next two games, they're playing in the Pac-12 title game. It's crazy to think there's only two games left in the quote-unquote regular season, other than that final Pac-12 championship game weekend when other teams will all get to play each other who won't play in the Pac-12 title game. But John Canzano, the bald-headed truth, as you like to say, wrote an article saying the rivalry is back. I know that we both disagree with that, in the sense that it doesn't, I mean, well, I'll let you take first crack at that. Thoughts on that statement from Canzano in his column?
It's what he gets paid to do, right? And this is the second time that he's tried to prematurely, illegitimately, and fraudulently declare that the Civil War rivalry is back. Remember, he tried to declare this in 2016 when the Beavers carried Gary Anderson off the field after a Civil War win against the worst Oregon football team in probably a decade, the worst defense certainly in a decade, maybe the history of Oregon football, and they carried 4-8 Gary Anderson off the field. He tried to declare it was back then. It wasn't. Oregon ended up dominating that matchup for three straight years, and now he's trying to do the same thing. Is this Oregon State team better than Gary Anderson's led Oregon State team? I think everyone would be willing to say yes there. But is the rivalry back? I don't know about that, man. I think there is still a massive gap between Oregon football, recruiting, the university, resources, funding, alumni, etc., and the junior college up in Corvallis. That's the Oregon State Beavers.
That's well said, and I agree. And I also think if you polled Oregon fans and said, which team do you hate more, Washington or Oregon State? I think it would be Washington in a landslide, simply because the Huskies have been a lot better than Oregon State in recent years, and more of a threat to Oregon in recent years, even though the Ducks have beaten both of those programs like a drum for the larger part of the last two decades. Washington definitely poses a bigger threat. And like you said, the talent disparity is real. I almost felt like good for the Beavers. I was like, oh, good for them. I mean, it's only the second time they've won this thing in 14 years. You know, I mean, I was like, if this would have happened last year, where Oregon had a real shot at a Rose Bowl or even for a second a college football playoff, they're at least in a top five, top 10 team constantly in the national discussion, then Oregon fans would be super pissed. But in a COVID stricken year where the regular season doesn't even really make sense and the Pac-12 has no shot at the playoff anyway, I think Oregon fans collectively, I could just kind of sense from at least a lot of my friends who went to U of O, they weren't nearly as bummed. Still bummed, but you kind of are like, oh, okay, it's a COVID year. Oregon wasn't going to the playoff anyway. Move on. So I agree with you in that sense. All right, let's move on to Harbaugh. Penn State 27, Michigan 17 in the Big House for Penn State's first win of the year. Big Tony, SS.
Like I keep saying on the show, every week it's something new. You think that Harfraud and the Michigan Wolverines can't get any lower, but yet Saturday night and then Sunday rolls around and there they are, somehow, some way, more pathetic than they were the week before. And the slander pieces are amazing. I want to read a couple of facts here for you folks. This is from some random Joe on Twitter, @JoePompliano. Highest paid college football coaches, Chief. Saban's at 9.1. He's tops the list. Ed O, also a fraud, 8.7 million a year. Dabo at 8.3 million a year. And then Chief coming in at number four, that's Jim Harbaugh. Now, what do all four of those coaches have, not in common, but let me just read this group statistic to you, okay? So Saban, Sweeney, and Ed O have won the last three national championships. And Harbaugh, Chief, he just lost the double digits to an 0-5 Penn State team. Context for you right there, for the guy that's making $8 million a year. Also on Twitter, someone put together a compilation of all 22 of Jim Harbaugh's losses. I would strongly encourage you to look at that. Hilarious stuff. Especially that Michigan State one where the Michigan punter like fumbled the ball and then they returned it to win. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That was my all-time favorite. And then here's one more tweet that I'll read. This is some good stuff. So someone just screen-capped a graphic from an ABC cast, and it reads, Michigan under Jim Harbaugh since 2015. 0-5 versus Ohio State, 3-3 versus Michigan State, 11-16 versus ranked teams. That's incredible. 2-12 versus top 10 teams. That's somehow even more incredible. And 0 Big Ten championships. You want me to read that again, or did that sink in for you?
Give me that one more time.
0-5 versus Ohio State, 3-3 versus Michigan State, 11-16 versus ranked teams, 2-12 versus top 10 teams, and a whopping goose egg, Dunkin' Donuts, Owen Wilson for Big Ten championships.
Yeah, there it is.
one more stat for you. Harbaugh has 0 wins as an underdog in his 6 years at Michigan. Mel Tucker in the state for Michigan State head coach, he's already won 2 games as an underdog at Michigan State in his first year. Mel Tucker, Harbaugh has 0 wins again as an underdog in his 6 years at Michigan. That is insane. All these stats are real. I'm not making these up. These are legitimate facts. And Harbaugh's making $8 million a year.
A charade. Feinbaum. He needs to beg, cry, and plead for an NFL job. No one enjoys Harbaugh losing besides you more than your guy Paul Feinbaum, who's always good for a hysterical, overly dramatic yet accurate Harbaugh take. here's what I would say. The college football coaching market and salary structure, let me emphasize salary structure, has really gotten completely out of control. They were talking about both the guys' buyouts, both James Franklin and Jim Harbaugh. Yeah, that was just a hilarious game, by the way. 0-5 James Franklin versus hotter than hot seat Jim Harbaugh. and 0-5 Franklin comes up with the win. They were talking about both their buyouts because Harbaugh only has 1 year left on his deal. So they might just like let him coach. I mean, they'll probably fire him at the end of this year. I certainly would. But there's a small chance they just let him, you know, coach out the rest of his contract next year. I wouldn't do that. I'd cut bait, swallow the $8 million and then leave. So they're going to have to give Harbaugh like $8 million next year if they fire him. James Franklin is on the books for $30 million through the next couple of years, guaranteed. So he could literally not win a single game next year, and then they'd fire him, and then they would be on the hook for not only the payment that year, but the rest of the $30 million after that without him coaching a game. How in the world does that incentivize someone to perform to their peak at that job? If you know in the back of your mind, geez, no matter what, I'm getting $30 million over the next couple of years. Like, how in the world do you wake up every day just starving to be the best? You don't, other than like Saban and Urban Meyer, who have clearly proven to be two of the goats in this world of college football, who had giant contracts and still were bringing home natties. And as much as it pains me to say it, the preacher Dabo Swinney somehow has legitimately brought home multiple national titles. So I probably have to throw him in that category too. Although accomplishment wise, he's obviously not on Saban or Urban's level. But that's my point, is the salary structure, man. It's out of control. I think a couple things happened. I think he almost beat Ohio State legitimately a couple of years ago when that home cooking ref gave JT Barrett a favorable spot in that fourth down rushing play. And I think that kind of started to break Harbaugh. And then, as my bro Joe Highfield pointed out as we were talking about, and I think I've brought this up before, they played him, I believe it was the next year, or maybe the year after that, it was Dwayne Haskins' year. Michigan trotted in like the number two defense in America statistically because they played frickin' Rutgers and Maryland all year. And then Ohio State dropped 60 on their ass and won by 30. And that just broke Harbaugh. And in his mind, he had to be like, well, A, I'm never beating Ohio State. Therefore, I'm never winning a conference title. And hey, you know what? I get $24 million guaranteed to me over these next 3 years. I'm good. And down goes the motivation. Down goes the recruiting. Down goes the program.
I don't know if I can sit here and try to put myself in Harfraud's shoes. That guy's a straight-up maniac. I wouldn't even be able to think for a second about what that guy thinks about on a daily basis. So I don't know about the motivation. I just know the facts. And again, the thing that really rubs me the wrong way is just how much shit that guy's talked throughout his entire career, not just at Michigan, but at other stops, and how much he's getting paid. And if you're getting paid that much and you talk a ton of shit and you're rude and just a total a-hole, all this stuff is just icing on the shit sundae, man. It really is. And to see him get embarrassed like this on a weekly basis, oh, man. It's like Christmas morning for your boy, Chief. It really is. And every week it gets lower. And every week I come on this podcast with a big sheet-eating grin, ready to lambaste that guy. Because he deserves it. My final point.
How big was your smile during that Penn State-Michigan game?
0-5 Penn State. The worst Penn State team in as long as probably Penn State football has been around. Really gave it to him, Chief. Really gave it to Harbaugh at home in the Big House. A team that you said was borderline lifeless. Beat him by double digits. And one quick point before I get back to Harbaugh. I'm not letting Don Brown off the hook, man. That guy is a total fraud. 417 yards Penn State racked up on them. On Don Brown's stinky stop unit. That's another 400-plus yard game that his stinky stop unit has surrendered, man. That guy is a total used car salesman, and he's getting paid way too much. And going back to Harbaugh for my final point, they have to fire him because if you let him stay and you don't extend him, that's a terrible message to recruits, right? Who's going to want to go there? So for that sole reason, you have to fire him. Everyone here knows that Michigan has money. The brain trust, the alumni, the association, the booster, they all got money, man. They can easily afford that $8 million. It's going to hurt. It'll be a tough pill to swallow. But you gotta cut the fat. You got to let Harbaugh go. Find someone that isn't a fraud and isn't stubborn and won't embarrass your program on a weekly basis, a program that is as proud and has as much history as Michigan does. Get a guy like Matt Campbell. Get a guy like Luke Fickell. Get someone in there, for God's sake, that isn't going to cost you $8 million a year and lose to a winless Penn State team by double digits at home in the Big House.
It's well said. I would go Matt Campbell or Luke Fickell as well. And I want to reemphasize one more time, the reason Harbaugh deserves this weekly slander, other than just the constant underperforming, is that he's getting paid a ton of money. And all the shit talking he did in all those press conferences for so long before this year, and even at Big Ten media days, and just trying to start fights with Urban Meyer and James Franklin and subtle jabs and all that. It'd totally be one thing if he was like Cristobal, where he was making $2 million a year and he was a grown ass man, mature, not picking fights with other coaches in the conference and guaranteeing wins and calling people soft and saying, you know, candy ass skim milk. It'd be one thing if he was just like a grown man, mature, not picking fights and not making a like, you know, a considerable about a considerable more amount of money than his peers. But he's making a ton more than his peers, and he's not producing wins, and he's still being immature as hell. And that is exactly why he deserves the slander. All right, you want to move on, or do you have anything else on Harbaugh?
Well said. I think you hit the nail on the hair. You hit the nail on the head there for the conclusion.
Bama rolls in the Iron Bowl, 42-13. Wasn't even that close. Bo Nix, zero touchdowns, two picks. I watched pretty much the whole game. It was actually kind of a boring Iron Bowl, unfortunately. To be fair, Bo Nix did put a 50-yard deep ball beautifully on the money to Seth Williams, who had like 5 yards of separation from, I believe it was Surtain. And Seth Williams, who's one of the best receivers in the country, just dropped a perfect pass, and it would have been a walk-in touchdown. But Bo Nix still struggled besides that play. Mac Jones, meanwhile, 18 of 26, 302 yards, 5 touchdowns, 0 picks. Devontae Smith, no one turns a slant route into a 60-yard score quite like him. John Mechie doing his thing out wide as well, number 8. And then Najee Harris, they throw him the ball a lot. He runs it solidly. It's not the best Bama running attack ever, but he's a freak of nature. I don't see anyone beating Bama this year, Tony. A couple of my big takeaways from the game are, number one, Mac Jones will probably win the Heisman, either him or Kyle Trask, depending on what happens in the SEC title game. I think Trevor Lawrence has lost too much ground after not playing unbelievable early, and then also just being out for a couple games with COVID. He would have to be like completely flawless from here on out, and Jones and Trask would have to fall off. Justin Fields threw 3 picks against Indiana, and then Ohio State had their game against Illinois canceled this last weekend, so his stock's down in terms of Heisman. Those are my big takeaways from that Bama game. Is, number one, Sark was ready to run the score up, and I probably should have seen that coming and thrown coin on Bama -24.5. Just such a big spread for an Iron Bowl. Which, by the way, Gus Malzahn was previously 3-4 in the Iron Bowl, which is actually a really good record for anyone facing Bama. Most teams facing Bama under Saban are like 1-9. But yeah, that's what I got for you. I got Mac Jones looking like a Heisman contender, and Bama looking like the team to beat for the title.
Auburn hasn't won at Alabama in the Iron Bowl since 2010. That was with Cam Newton and that ridiculously lucky but also pretty solid Auburn team. And whenever it's not at Jordan-Hare and Auburn is ranked, whenever those two aren't the case, Bama usually rolls in this Iron Bowl. So I wasn't surprised to see them take care of business and spank Malzahn and that Auburn team this weekend. I like your take about Alabama just being so loaded and having so many weapons, man. And it's crazy because every year they just reload, right? Every single year they get a ton of wide receivers. They get a really solid running back or two or three. I think even one year they had 4 running backs on their roster that are like stars in the pros right now. It's insane. And they've been reloading with quarterback too as of late. I mean, ever since they started doing that, they started getting the quarterback position shored up. It's been a wrap, really. I agree with you. I don't think that anyone beats Bama this year. And I say that just because of how ridiculously explosive their offense is. Their defense has some holes, but I don't think anyone outscores them when they're at full strength and they're really trying. So it's crazy, man. They look like just an unstoppable force this year, even though Clemson and Ohio State still look really solid.
So I tweeted this out, but Bama had 4 offensive players taken in the top 15 of the draft earlier this spring. I went back and looked up the first round board. Tua, top 5. Jedrick Wills, the left tackle, top 10. And Ruggs and Judy, top 15. And then Jaylen Waddle, who has been their best receiver and is their highest pro prospect, got hurt in the Tennessee game on that opening kickoff. Unfortunately, he's out for the year. And they're still unstoppable. I mean, they're unstoppable with Devontae, Najee, John Mechie, a couple other dudes, and Mac Jones just slinging it. It's crazy. I don't know what to say about Bo Nix. Just he looks the part. I know his dad played there. That gets that story gets retold about eight times a broadcast. He was like a high-ranked recruit, I think a five-star even by some services, set Alabama state records. But like, I don't know what it is. I don't want to say he's like dumb because I've never talked to the guy, so that would be like rude and not accurate. But I don't know what is holding him back, because physically he looks like he has everything. I mean, he's got a pretty good arm. He's actually a pretty good athlete. The best part about his game is that he runs well. He had, like, the only time Auburn really somewhat moved the ball was consistently Bo Nix scrambles in that game. He just hasn't put it together yet, that's got to be a concern if you're an Auburn fan. Like I've said this before, I would treat him like Nick Marshall and just run him most of the time and then have him chuck it every now and then. I know that might not be a super sustainable strategy, but that's the best you're going to get from him, just because the passing game, despite the fact that they have two really good receivers in Seth Williams and Schwartz, and actually Eli Stove is a really good college player. I don't know what his pro prospects are, but he's a damn good college player too. They just have, the passing game just hasn't really clicked.
Yeah, I don't really care to comment on Bo Nix, what's going wrong, what's not going right for Auburn's offense. I don't watch enough of Auburn's games, nor do I really care that much about Bo Nix and Auburn. I like your point, though. I guess I don't understand either why he's not good. I've seen him play multiple times, and he's so athletic, and he's built like a quarterback, and he has a strong arm. He just doesn't put it together. And that's kind of the case for a lot of these QBs in college, right, Chief? A lot of them have the tools, they have the build, they have the athleticism, and they just don't put it together, man. I mean, shit, some of the QBs in the pros don't put it together. Just look how bad Mitchell Trubisky is. That guy has everything in the book that you would need to be a good quarterback, and yet he's right. Not a good quarterback. He's very terrible. So some people just have it, some people just don't. In college, obviously, that's more prevalent than in the pros. But yeah, Bo Nix, and at some point, you got to figure, all right, this has gone on long enough. We probably need to go in another direction.
Okay, I got a couple more takes left here as we kind of whip through this pod. Number one, LSU's offense is – I don't think I've ever seen a team go from best offense of all time looking to inept the way that LSU has gone from last year to this year. We know about all their departures. We know that Ja'Marr Chase was like, nah, I'm good to play in this year. We know Joe Brady's gone, Joe Burrow's gone, like O-linemen, multiple O-linemen literally left early. That's how good they were. But man, TJ Finley was really struggling. I know he's a freshman, but against A&M, 9 of 25, 118 yards, 0 touchdowns, 2 picks. This A&M game was incredibly boring. I watched like the first 2.5 quarters and I just like couldn't do it anymore. A&M ends up winning 20-7 in what's generally a pretty good SEC West game. Obviously, LSU's dropped so far this year that it wasn't. But A&M stays in the top five with that win. They had a pick six in there. LSU scored some garbage time touchdown that must have, fourth quarter, 7 points, some garbage time touchdown, because it was like 20-0 through three, 13-0 for most of the game. And then they kept throwing in this lefty white dude, Max Johnson, who wasn't much better, although he did throw a touchdown. I don't know. LSU's quarterback situation is just in total shambles. Speaking of LSU, Les Miles siphoning money from the Kansas program as they just continue to look lifeless and they continue to be winless. TCU was up 24-0 in literally 3 seconds in that game. And then, Tony, a topic that's near and dear to your heart, Vandy football. The weirdest spread of all time. They were 1-point favorites against Missouri this weekend, and they lost 41-0 in the Sarah Fuller history game.
All right, let me comment on all those. Edo is the new Gene Chizik. I've been saying this for a while, Chief. I was one of the first to hop on that IPO. I was before pre-IPO. I was Series A. In terms of calling Edo a fraud, he is a fraud, folks. He got lucky last year, like Chizik got lucky with the transcendent quarterback, first round talent at every position, and Joe Brady doing all of the offensive coaching. If it weren't for Joe Brady, that offense would still be prehistoric. Remember the year before that, they scored 0 points in a primetime game at Tiger Stadium versus Alabama football. They couldn't even move the ball. It was pathetic. Joe Brady, Joe Burrow, and all those first rounders are the reason that they did anything last year. Edo, he's just Gene Chizik with the Raising Cane sponsorship, Chief.
He really is. He really is. And he got divorced after last year, too. You know, he's just on a party train.
Jesus, that's out of control, man. Second point, Les Miles siphoning money from the Kansas athletic department. That's a tough scene, but what was Kansas football before he showed up, right? This is one of those things where he's a huge fraud. They suck. But at least it's Kansas football, whereas Harfraud goes to Michigan, and you know Michigan's a decent team with some solid history and a proud alumni fan base and all that. And he's stinking it up there. It's a much bigger deal than Les Miles stinking up at Kansas. But we should definitely hold him accountable, especially with how good of a coach he once was and how terrible of a coach he is now and how bad Kansas football is. My last point on the Vandy game. That game was so bad that head coach Derek Mason actually got fired. I watched the entire game because I wanted to see Sarah Fuller get the chance to score. She had a kickoff. I love this.
Wait, Derek Mason got fired?
He got fired.
Oh, shit. I didn't see that. It is about time.
Yeah, he got fired.
Former Stanford coach.
It is about time. They're terrible. 0-8 this year. But I watched the whole game because I wanted to see them, for God's sakes, just get in field goal range, and they couldn't do it. I have never, and I mean never, watched a worse game in my entire life than that Vandy versus Missouri game. Missouri was doing whatever they wanted on offense, and they weren't even trying on defense, and Vandy couldn't move the ball. They couldn't even get into field goal range for Greg Zuerlein, let alone Sarah Fuller, and they lost 41-0. It was so pathetic. At least Sarah got to go out there and squib a kickoff, which was pretty solid effort on her part. It was designed, folks, for all the folks on Twitter trying to rip her. It was a design squib kick. But for God's sake, I know she's got a leg, man. Can you at least get inside the opponent's 25? And Vandy couldn't even do that. It was the most pathetic total team performance outside of Sarah's kickoff, obviously, that I've ever seen. And I would have fired Derek Mason on the spot. I don't know why they waited until today to do it.
I don't know how Anthony Lynn hasn't been fired right now. I'm checking my phone. It's 10:04 p.m. I'm waiting for that Chargers ESPN notification that says Anthony Lynn is fired. I'm not going to lie. I was laughing because I wanted Sarah Fuller to get an opportunity to kick so bad, but it was also so Vandy that they just couldn't even get in field goal range for this kicker. And by the way, they'd been greasing it up all week, as they should have been. You know, it's a historic moment. They were tweeting out videos of her like nailing PATs in practice in their indoor practice facility, and then they didn't even get in field goal range. That is just such a Vandy
and then Derek
moment.
Fired.
That is exactly so Vandy. Go ahead.
Can I ask you something, Chief?
Yeah.
Why is Vandy in the SEC? Shouldn't they just be booted by now?
I was just about to say that. When we came up with our list of which programs would look the other way to hire Hugh Freeze, I said everyone in the SEC but Vandy. And that is a clear indication of why. Because they're the one team in the conference with morals, and they're the one university with morals and a high level academic standing, according to, you know, university folks out there who rank schools, etc. And dude, even with Jay Cutler, who, say what you want about Jay Cutler, but yeah, I mean, the guy was freaking talented. At least even with Jay Cutler, they were winning like six games a year. And James Franklin miraculously got them to like 8 wins 1 year in a fraudulent SEC East, but he did it. I don't know how, but they did. But I agree. I mean, if you look at Vandy, first of all, their stadium holds like 20,000 people. It looks like, I mean, it's probably significantly smaller than most Texas high school stadiums. Their facilities aren't anything to write home about. There's clearly no buy-in from the university. I mean, how in the world do you recruit football players to go there? Like, I'm not even necessarily full on blaming Derek Mason. Like, how in the world would you get even like a high three, low four star kid to go to Vandy over any of those other SEC schools? I mean, it just seems impossible. Even over Memphis, you'd go to Memphis over, or SMU, good American programs, over Vandy in a heartbeat in terms of playing competitive football.
Memphis, SMU, Cincy, UCF, you're going to all those schools over Vandy if you want to play football. I'm surprised that they even field a team, man. And by the looks of it on Saturday, it didn't look like they did field a team.
Yeah, they should just go. They should just go independent. I mean, good luck to that next coach. I don't know, with no university buy-in and no strong, passionate football alumni base. Clearly not great facilities. I don't even know how you. Saban could coach that team this year and they'd win maybe one game, if that. Final couple topics: the Egg Bowl. Kiffin wins it. Matt Golden Corral was launching bombs in that one. I watched most of it. He was just he had a classic Matt Corral moment. Just multiple like 60-yard touchdowns that he just threw into the night sky that came down for touchdowns there in Oxford. Just hilarious. 31-24 is closer than it really was. Ole Miss was up, 10-14 most of that game. 31-17 for a lot of it. And so that was that. And then Michigan State football, who has lost to Iowa by like 42, won at Michigan, and has gotten blown out in losses in other games, turns around and I think their last game before this weekend was a 24-7 home loss to Indiana. They turn around and they beat Northwestern 29-20, Big Tony. I'm not saying Northwestern was like a legit number six team or whatever they were ranked, number eight. They weren't. But I can't make sense of Michigan State football, and I can't make sense of Big Ten football. And that brought me to my bigger point, which I said last week and I'll reiterate again. Folks, literally never bet on Big Ten football because the results make zero sense from week to week.
Mel Tucker left the cupboard bare at Colorado. He really did. Somehow, two massive wins on the season versus Michigan. Little brother, little Harbaugh. And now against the number eight ranked Northwestern. It makes no sense. The Big Ten makes no sense. Unless it's Ohio State, I'm done with that conference. I really am.
Agreed, man. And finally, my final topic, Jake Paul and Nate Robinson, Big Tony. I saw the videos. That was an L for the culture. We had a lot of NBA players voicing their support for Nate Robinson. And damn, Jake Paul, the 23-year-old YouTube star, tatted white dude with a big old right hook, and Nate went nine-night on that mat.
Jake Paul, the YouTube kingpin, he put him to sleep, man. He really did. I didn't watch that whole fight. You could not pay me enough to watch that whole fight, let alone I actually would have to pay for it. I don't know how people actually pay for that, but it's 2020, man. It felt like a total 2020 move, 2020 fight. Jake Paul was working it, man. It looked like he was by far the better fighter, in way better shape, knew what he was doing. And he had knocked Nate down multiple times before that. But that last combo that you're seeing on Twitter, that was the one that put Nate to sleep for good, man. And after that, even those that are in the NBA and for the culture and all that, they were clowning him. Twitter was ruthless. I saw some absolutely out of control memes, videos, tweets, IG posts. It was completely insane to watch and then see social media's reaction. Like I said, it was just a total way to kind of cap off. We still got a whole month left, not even in December of 2020. But that was such a 2020 thing to have happen, just a YouTube kingpin knocking out Nate Robinson. And let me just say this, man. If you're Nate, why are you taking that fight, right, Chief? That is a lose-lose. If you beat the hell out of a 23-year-old, like, skinny YouTuber, all right, well, weren't you supposed to do that? But if you lose, and worst-case scenario, if you get knocked out like he did and the way that he did get knocked out, then it becomes like a legitimate resume staining moment where now, before the fight, you bring up Nate Robinson's name. Three-time dunk champion, dual sport athlete at UW, NBA vet, played a bunch of seasons, great sixth man, you know, good guy overall. You pretty much would have nothing bad to say about him. And then after the fight, that's probably, sadly, with today's day and era and social media and all that, one of the first things that you're going to bring up.
Well, I'll say this. Why did he take the fight? Follow the money. In every business decision, folks, it almost always comes down to the one basic economic question of follow the money. A concept that the great Bernie Sanders is still working on is, where's the money coming from? We don't know. We don't know where the money's coming from, but Bernie says taxes. I'm not sure what that means. There has been no elaboration. Back to the real world.
Hold on. Can I stop there?
Yeah.
Can I stop there? I'm reading a report here. Jake Paul and Nate Robinson will also earn an equal share, with each picking up $600,000 each. For $600,000, Nate Robinson agreed to a lose-lose proposition that would potentially tarnish his career, and it did. $600,000 after taxes, you're probably looking at like $3 and change after taxes. You did all that. You did all of that for a house in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
A house in Tulsa. Here's the deal. Nate lives in Washington, to my knowledge. No state income tax up there, folks. He's bringing that in. But I need to look up his career earnings. Nate Robinson career earnings. Give me a second here.
Definitely a million. He's at least like probably 10 million plus in career earnings. Why are you taking
24 mil? 24 mil in NBA salaries. I really, really, really hope that he had a financial advisor put some of that in some kind of a savings account, whether it's a 401k or an IRA or just a general mutual fund savings account. Oh, I really hope so. If he didn't, that would be, because I'm just trying to think of reasons, and I'm by no means in no way accusing him of being a poor financial planner. I'm just thinking out loud, why would he take that fight other than money? You know what I mean? Like, I don't think he's doing it for public notoriety. I mean, I think he is a fondly remembered athlete, like some 5'9 guy who somehow made the NBA and hung around for a long time and balled out in dunk contests. I mean, that's kind of how I think all of us remembered him and can still choose to remember him. But in this day and age of social media, it is tough to unsee that. The other thing I'll say too is he's 36, I believe, and Jake Paul is 23. I mean, a retired 36-year-old athlete is beyond your prime with a ton of wear and tear on those tires. And I mean, he still looks like he's in really good shape. I'm not saying he's not. But 36 is a long ways away from a 23-year-old kind of entering your prime bodybuilding type dude. Who, by the way, Jake Paul was a lot bigger than Nate Robinson. I don't know what the official weigh-in was, but Jake Paul looked like he was two weight classes above Nate Robinson too.
I have a lot of questions. We can move on. We can wrap it up, but I will never forget opening Twitter on a Saturday night. I know exactly Saturday, November 28th, 2020. It was about like 9:30, opening Twitter and seeing that pop up as the first thing on my timeline. I believe it was like I think it was a Barstool tweet too. It was like Jake Paul put Nate Robinson to sleep, and I watched it, and I was thinking to myself, is this real? Like, did this just happen? I mean, I remember them like talking about this fight going, did this really happen? And then as I was scrolling, the slander intensified, and I knew that he was at that point just a part of the Twitter sphere. That is a tough look, man. I need answers. We need to do an official investigation into why Nate Robinson took that fight.
Final comment from me. I will just reiterate a Daniel Popper article, the Chargers beat writer for The Athletic, who's gaining quite the following, actually, from Chargers fans and really the nation. His tweets are kind of blowing up. Final, Bills 27, Chargers 17. Anthony Lynn's limitations as a game and time manager laid bare for all to see today. Horrific, inexcusable decision-making throughout this game. And it blew up, 288 retweets, you know, 1,600-plus likes. Do the Chargers give Anthony Lynn the tarmac treatment? Or, I mean, he's just a dead man walking at this point. I guess you maybe keep him around for the rest of the year because you're just going to fire him at the end and there's only five games left or whatever. But him, Clay Helton, and Harbaugh might be the three leaders in the clubhouse for dead man walking coaches right now.
And USC is 3-0 right now, which is hilarious. But yeah, I agree. I think that those are certainly three of the hottest seats in football right now.
Anthony Lynn, come on, bro. What are we doing? We can talk Chargers another time. We'll wrap it up. Tony, thanks for popping on, big dog. Always good to chat with you. And folks, we had to do it for you on a Sunday night. So Tony, we'll be cranking out the content more this week with another college football Saturday and NFL Sunday coming up.
Yes, sir. Folks, appreciate you tuning in. Much love. We'll see you next week.